Thank you for joining us at the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Please note this podcast does not intend to offer medical advice or therapeutic treatment for any medical condition for either yourself or others. If you have any medical or rehabilitation concerns for yourself or your child, please contact your physician. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the OT Corner with Mrs. K., a school-based occupational therapist bringing you a series of interviews and information on childhood development for kids with all different abilities. So get ready, get set, let's go.
Hello, this is Mrs. K, and today I have a good friend of mine, actually, and a school psychologist, Jen Mattis, as a guest today on the OT Corner. Hi, Jen, how you doing?
Great. How are you doing, Jen?
Good. Thanks so much for coming on. So interestingly enough, Jen and I have been in community theater together, and I did not know that she was a school psychologist. But first of all, Jen, how did you have an interest in becoming a school psychologist? What brought you into that field?
I didn't really at first. I just always knew I wanted to work with kids. I used to volunteer at the local elementaries in high school and college. And I was originally going to be clinical pediatric psych. And when the funding for that fell through, I took a year off and then realized that one of the best school psych programs was literally in my backyard at Kent State. And so I decided to go for it. It was nice because it gave me an opportunity to make a difference and have an impact, but also to be around for my own kids. Being on a school schedule was very enticing.
So, that is nice working in the school systems. I will agree that you are on your children's.
Well, and it's very nice. I love what I do because I can make a systemic impact. I can work with one child, but if I work with the teacher and I work with a couple of teachers, then now essentially I'm working with both of their classrooms because giving them ideas or strategies or letting them try out new techniques or ideas affects everybody for the better, not just that one child.
I agree. So how long have you been a school psychologist altogether?
I think this is my 37th year.
Okay. So you've probably seen a lot of change over the years.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
And so IDEA came into play around 1973. When did you start in the schools? What year did you start in the schools?
I started in 1984. Public Law 94-142 is the original. That's what everything came from. That was signed into law in 1975, and then it was enacted for the 76-77 school year. So that was the first year that Public Law 94-142 went into effect. That law guaranteed the right to an IEP, FAPE, which is a free and appropriate education delivered in the least restrictive environment, with an appropriate evaluation, with the participation of the parent, and with procedural safeguards in place. Those were the six main tenets of that law. In 1986, that law was amended to become Education for All Handicapped Children. And that guaranteed services starting at birth. And then in 1990, it was amended again to become IDEA. And that included, for the first time, traumatic brain injury and autism as areas of disability where kids could be served. In 1997, it was amended again. And the last amendment was in 2004. Officially now it's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Improvement Act. So that added early intervention, more accountability for better academic achievement for kids on IEPs. It increased the standards for teachers who are teaching students with disabilities, and it required the use of research-based interventions prior to evaluations. And so that's when intervention teams and response to intervention situations arose throughout schools and created that more of a team approach. I mean, when I first started, we would have fall conferences and I would come in the building the next day. Granted, I was in this building one day a week and I would have 15 referrals in my mailbox. No interventions, no prior anything, just 15 referrals. So things have changed for the better quite a bit.
Yeah. And then I do a lot of response to intervention initially, you know, the different tiers of intervention. And it's interesting how that system all works out if it's used properly. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, sometimes I'll do groups of, you know, interventions. There's maybe a handful of kiddos that are having some issues in a class. And then sometimes, you know, I do pick them up. Sometimes we don't need to because the intervention exactly. has helped.
Exactly. So
it really has evened this stuff out. And then you don't have a student on an IEP that probably may not need all that intervention or that direct intervention. They just exactly. need a little bit of startup. So now I know that we had talked earlier prior to this, you know, you coming on, and how was this received by parents, like initially this law?
Back in the day, there was a lot of mixed reaction to this law. At local MRDD boards or county MRDD boards, they had pretty nice facilities. I mean, in Portage County, it was Weaver School. In Summit County, Portage County was Happy Day. Summit County was Weaver. But I mean, they had pools and washing machines, and they taught these students how to use public transportation and how to budget and shop and those kinds of things. And there were a lot of parents that were really leery of their children going to a regular public high school or school and not learning those things. So it took a while. It was gradual. And in the very beginning, parents had a choice of whether they wanted their children to remain at the MRDD school or go to the regular public school. Now those aren't options anymore. Educators pushed hard because really the most funding that came from any of these updates to the initial public law in 94-142, that law brought financial assistance to schools to help pay for everything. To pay for the teachers, the training, the new classrooms that they would need and those kinds of things. But a lot of the mandates that have come down since are unfunded. And so that's always hard for schools to, you know, to match the requirement for service without any money, additional money to do so. But they do it. I mean, they have to do it. So we do it. But I think now I don't think many parents would want their children to be in a separate facility.
Yeah, a lot of people want. I mean, I have a child with a disability,
right.
I think that going to school is a great opportunity for her and being included in all these different specials. Like she's in orchestra and she's able to participate on the track team. Accommodations are always being made for her, which is great.
Yes, as they should be. I mean, this is how it should look.
And it's interesting you talk about the funding part there. One of my guests, Bob Sirianni, who was recently on, he is in academia at Salus University in Philadelphia, and they're teaching their students now this collaborative approach to delivering services based on, you know, the funding is limited and we have less time as educators now to deliver these services to our kids. Mm-hmm. So coming up with different ways of delivery of the service, it's interesting how this is all evolving now as we speak. And because, you know, you work with people that have been educators for years and it didn't look like that. And it's just hard to get used to and transitioning to that type of delivery service. So it's interesting how it's all coming down. And it's, you know, it's nice that parents understand this and know this information too.
Yeah, it's hard to, you know, it's like turning a massive boat around. It takes a while. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn it all at once, you're going to flip the whole thing. So, you know, it's a process. So every time something new comes down, there's a process. You know, I remember the first time we had an intervention team meeting and the teachers weren't thrilled to have to be on it, but once they saw what it did and how much good it could do for kids, it got a huge following within the school. So it just changes hard for a lot of people.
It is. Now, when and this initially happened when the, because I know how kids are identified now in the school system when they come in at 3 years old. You know, I work a lot with preschoolers. And so I'll have the school psychologist will come to me and they'll have a referral, like a 10-month-old kid. We do their initial evaluation. What did this, like, how has this changed over the years from like identifying kids in preschool to now? Like, how did it look like that? Like it looks now, like back, you know, in the 90s, or were kids identified later on? How did that look?
Typically the kids coming into preschool are already flagged by Help Me Grow. And so Help Me Grow is who contacts the school and lets them know that there's a kid coming, a toddler preschooler coming in, he's turning three. I didn't work much with preschool back in the 90s because there wasn't a preschool mandate. So that preschool mandate, I don't remember when that came through, but it's still, as far as I know, it's still, some of the students are typically developing students and some of the students are students with identified disabilities. But that part, I'm not sure how that's changed. I know that in general, the entire referral and evaluation process has changed over time. And I'm assuming that preschool followed that same kind of evolution from, you know, a simple one page summary by someone to that multi-factored, multidisciplinary approach to make sure that we've looked at all aspects of that child's development, not just one.
And then now, you know, from my standpoint as an occupational therapist, I have seen over the years, now even before COVID, I've seen an increase of referrals. Have you seen, like in that age group, like the 3 to 6 year old age group, have you seen that as well on your end?
Yeah,
like even before COVID?
Yeah, I actually spent a year working in Garfield Heights in their preschool program. I was the school psych for their preschool program for a year as a sub. But yeah, there were a lot of increased referrals. I mean, we see that. I'm in a private school now, so we don't really deal with IEPs too much, but we do see kids coming in who have IEPs. You know, they have speech or autism or OT or PT. And then the providers just come to us and provide services while the child's in school with us. They do itinerant services. I do see an increase in referrals, and I don't know what that's from. I don't know if parents are better educated, if the schools are doing a better job of alerting parents that services are available, if pediatricians are getting a little more training in developmental kinds of things, which typically they don't. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's causing the uptick, but I don't think it's just the referral. I mean, I think a lot of these kids legitimately qualify for services. So yeah, we are seeing more. And my counterparts in the public school district where I work would also say that they're seeing more kids.
So, so I wanted to touch too on that private school part. Now, like for my daughter, Raina, we ended up putting her back in Philadelphia. She was in UCP, United Cerebral Palsy's preschool, or I'm sorry, daycare. And then we moved her over to a parochial school for preschool, and like a service provider would come out and they would, you know, treat her there. So how is that service look different from the private? So, you know, the person comes in, but how does that look different for you in a private school situation for these kiddos?
For preschool kids, I mean, because once you hit kindergarten, you're school age, and that's a whole different ball game. Mm-hmm. But for the preschool kids, it depends on the school. If a parochial school or a private school, an independent school, accepts federal funding, then they have to provide what's called an ISP. So it's an IEP, but instead of educational plan, it's called an individual service plan. And it's and then the private school does what they can on that IEP. My particular school doesn't accept we don't take funding, federal funding. And so we don't do ISPs. What we do is we take the IEP and we look at what services are being provided. And then we will come back and tell the family what we can provide from that IEP and what we can't, and what we can provide that the IEP doesn't. And then the parent makes the decision whether to go to the public school or stay in the private school. So with our preschool kids on IEPs though, those are held by the public school, and then they send an itinerant service provider over for, my goodness, we've had them in for OT, PT, speech, behavior, and social kinds of things. And so that's how that works for us for preschool. School age is different. Once you're school age and you say, I'm going to stay in the private school, the public school does not have to provide you services anymore. So a lot of our parents then apply for the scholarship, the John Peterson scholarship or the autism scholarship, and they use that money to pay for those extra services. Some parochial schools now are accepting the John Peterson scholarship, and so are some Christian schools. So they've become service providers for the scholarship, which means you can use your scholarship money to pay for tuition at those schools.
Yeah, we always give, when we go through our IEP meetings in the school systems, we always give information out about that, right? John Peterson scholarship, that funding is available to parents that may not want their children in the public school. Kind of back to that COVID issue. So how has this changed? I've seen a big uptick in the referrals for kids, because now, you know, kiddos that were born in 2020, they would be really old. In 2020, we've noticed that we're getting referrals from these kiddos. Fine motor problems. Right. What do you see as a school psychologist? What are some of the bigger issues that you're seeing with these kids?
We do see some motor issues. We see both fine and gross motor issues because kids have been confined to their houses. Now, they're not really running around outside because the parents are working and they can't supervise them. They weren't going to parks, playgrounds, playgroup, anything like that. But for me, primarily what I'm seeing is I'm seeing social emotional issues, and then I'm seeing some gaps in academics. Because depending on their access to the screen and their engagement with the screen and the teacher on the other end, some kids did great and some kids didn't do much learning at all during that time. But the social emotional piece is the most striking for me, because those are the referrals I get. So we have kids who have not really been socialized through no fault of parents, just because of COVID. So again, no parks, playgrounds, playgroups, no religious kinds of events, not really seeing grandmas and grandpas and cousins, and just really being kind of raised in isolation. And so now they're in a big group and it's a struggle to get them to handle it. Some kids are pretty resilient and they're doing great, and others need a lot more direct support. And they do master it. I don't think we're seeing an increase in kids with disabilities because of COVID. I think we're seeing an increase in children with needs. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those needs are so great that it's a disability, and it's more because of a lack of advantage that we're seeing those problems. So yeah, well, I think we're going to spend the next couple of years anyway catching up from that and getting things a little more back to normal. But right now the workload is definitely increased.
Lack of exposure. And I have seen, kiddos that, like you said, may have not, you know, may were not able to get vaccinated at that young age.
Right.
For a while. So parents didn't want it, which, you know, is super valid. You know, don't want them exposed to get them sick. So they didn't go out. I've seen little kiddos with, you know, decreased hand strength or core, so just because they haven't been able to move. And, you know, we always at this age group, even before this age group, play is how they develop, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Play is how they develop. I know that you mentioned even playing a game, like a board game that you were talking about, and how, I don't know if you can like talk about that a little bit, but I thought that was really interesting. The language piece to that, right?
I can't remember if we were talking about the O-Rats game.
Yes, the O-Rats game. Yes, that's exactly right. Yes.
So I was playing this game with two little kids in preschool. The premise of the game, it's very simple. You have a puzzle with six pieces. Each piece is a different color. You spin the spinner, whatever color it lands on, you get to put that color piece in your puzzle. And so it's very, very simple. But if you spin the spinner and it lands on a piece that you already have in your puzzle, you say, "Oh, rats." So it's a good way to teach how to play a game and how to take turns, but it's also a nice way to teach a response, a socially appropriate response to not getting what you want. But I had this little kid, this little guy, and every time we would do it, he modeled it many, many times. Every time he would land on a color he already had, I would look at him and I'd say, "What do you say?" And he would say, "Thank you." Every time. "What do you say?" "Thank you." And then he finally got on. So he finally was able to say "Oh, rats." So I'll see if he carries that with him when we go back to school.
But it is interesting. Like I've noticed too, like sometimes, and I'm not a speech language pathologist. I don't have any expertise, but I notice a lot of one word phrases or just, you know, pointing, you know, almost developmentally a little delayed.
Yes.
Language, because they haven't been
exposed. We're seeing a fair amount of mimicking. It's just parroting someone else's language. Mm-hmm. And then for this little guy, it was, I'm sure his parents, every time they would say something, "What do you say?" "Thank you." "What do you say?" So I was using that parental expression of "What do you say?" And that's the response I was getting. I feel for parents because for the most part, most of them were also trying to work, mm-hmm. and have a baby or a really young toddler in the house. I mean, I don't know how they did it. It was challenging enough to just, I mean, you did it with older kids, but still I can't imagine what that would have been like with a 1.5-year-old running around the house while you're sitting at home trying to work.
Yeah. And now too, teachers, because of that, teachers are dealing with, you know, a classroom full of these kids, mm-hmm. you know, so they have to, and the standards are there, you know, the preschool standards are there and now everything is shifted, you know, this way, you know, the bell curve is,
the bell curve's a little askew right now.
Yeah. And it's a little,
it's a global issue. It's not something unique to my school or your school. It's mm-hmm. everybody's feeling it and everything is shifted. I mean, in the United States, math scores went down for the first time in over 30 years.
Wow.
This past year. That has just not happened. And there's one thing to blame for it. And everybody's seeing the effects.
Well, I think too, there's been a lot of kids online. And they have the online schools or they were being schooled privately at home and things just, there's not a consistency across the delivery of how they're being educated, I guess, is probably a big contributor to that.
I mean, in 2020, when we all went back, when school started again in the fall, there were a lot of schools that were still remote. There were a lot of schools that were hybrid. In my school, we offered in class 5 days a week, but we also did offer remote learning for those kids who had a parent or a family member whose health was compromised and like technically was a, not literally, was a matter of life or death if that child would bring home COVID. So it was, I think, so it would have been the beginning of the 21 school year where we discontinued the option for remote learning.
Yeah, the school system that my older daughter was in, they were remote up until I think March of 2021.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, they were remote for a while. But the other, you know, the school system that I'm in, we were a mixture. It was hybrid. Some kids were online all the time. And then my daughter, Raina, actually, they had that qualification for kids that receive services or an IEP. You had to fill out that form. She was in school 5 days a week.
Oh, boy.
So she was in person 5 days a week, like right off the bat, like right when we came back. So
that's how, yeah, that's how my school was.
So it was interesting. It was interesting, the difference of, you know, and even in the school system that I was, it was the same case. Some kids were in 5 days a week, depending on if they, you know, their IEP, what that little formula ended up. So also I wanted to, you know, in this age group, have you seen, because of COVID, like increased mental health issues as well? I know you talked about the social participation piece, but what about any like increase in mental health issues with kids in this age group?
Not so much in this age group. What we've seen, and we typically don't see it until age about 4 or 5, we're seeing some behavioral issues. So children who don't have but their ability to self-regulate mm-hmm. is diminished. And then being in an environment where there are a lot of children and a lot of stimuli, it exacerbates that and makes it even harder for them to self-regulate and to not throw things or run around or do some of the other things. When we're talking about mental health issues, I'm seeing that in our older children. Okay. That's really where that's starting to come in for us. And I think, again, it's just a matter of how the situation played out for everybody and how everybody's family was able to manage or not manage, or and it was hard on everyone. But you know, there is a mental health crisis going on right now with children, and it is pretty much being blamed on COVID. There was a real sense of isolation for a lot of kids and being cut off socially. The problem now is they all got really good at being online. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a lot of that now when it would be better if they were socializing in person.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, social media and technology has its place in time. I don't, you know, I've also read in an article, I think it's in the Times, about how kids' bodies are developing faster than their brains are. So like puberty is coming on earlier.
It is.
And this is really affecting. So, you know, people might be blaming social media all the time, but it may be this part that they're developing earlier and their minds haven't caught up with. So that's another really interesting.
Well, and that's a whole other conversation actually, but
whole other episode.
it's social media isn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not going to go away, and technology is just going to get better and more invasive and intrusive in our lives. And I think our job as educators and as parents is to teach our kids how to handle it, mm-hmm. And when to walk away from it and how to take a break from it and how to put it down. And you know, we've got kids who won't go to bed without their cell phones next to them, and they're up checking it all night long. That really translates into problems in school because of sleep deprivation and preoccupation with all the social stuff that's going on. You know, when I was in school, it was what was the talk at the locker. That was the big deal. So these kids have a lot more to handle and a lot more to deal with.
Yeah. And I think it comes younger and younger, and even, you know, maybe those preschoolers are not on social media, but they're definitely understanding how to get to YouTube. And, you know,
that's for sure.
They know how to get there.
Yes, they do.
At a very early age.
Yes, they do. And a lot of them had, again, born out of necessity, a lot of them had excessive amounts of screen time during COVID. And I mean, I understand, I completely get it. It's just now we have to break away from that and get back to interpersonal learning. And as you said before, interactive play. Mm-hmm. And whether that means you're interacting with other children or you're interacting with your environment, that is how kids learn and develop. Nobody learns through the seat of their pants and a desk chair.
That's true. That's true.
You need to get up and move about, and that's how kids learn.
Now, you said that you had given some workshops that you did you do workshops with educators or parents? I can't remember what it was.
We primarily parents.
Primarily parents.
Yeah, I do 2 parent eds a year. That's the minimum. I typically do a little bit more than that, but we've repeated one that I did in the spring. We did it again this fall, just on setting boundaries and healthy limits. And that came from our parents, our preschool parents, at conferences in the fall and in the spring last year. The number one concern that the preschool teachers were coming to me with is, my parents are having a really hard time setting boundaries and saying no, and they need help. And so we put together about a 40-minute parent education on how to set those boundaries, how to enforce the boundaries, and how to take care of yourself as a parent in the process. Because it's, you know, if you're the one who's always filling everybody's cup, but yours is empty, it's really hard to be a good cup filler when you don't have anything left. So that was the main focus of that presentation. But again, we were offering, you know, alternatives to saying no, because if you find yourself saying no all the time, you can think of some other things to do. So for example, I want a cookie. Great, you can have a cookie after dinner, instead of, no, it's almost dinner time, you can't have a cookie. If there's just a difference in how we phrase things, or, you know, can I go skating? Yeah, great idea. As soon as your room is clean, you can go. As opposed to, no, you didn't clean your room, you can't go skating. It's just a different way of looking at parenting and setting those limits and those boundaries, so that it's not always so negative.
That's a great, I think parents these days, more and more. I mean, when I was growing up, my mother didn't really work that much when I was growing up, when I was young. She was always home when I was young. She didn't start really working until I got older. And I think parents these days are working from the time, I mean, they're back to work sometimes within 3 months of having their child, or even sooner sometimes.
Yeah. And that's, again, born out of necessity. The way the economy has shifted, it's almost impossible to raise a family on one salary today, unless you're making a ridiculous amount of money.
Everybody's doing that realistically. So it's, you know, I think, you know, me as well, is, you know, I think that you spread yourself too thin sometimes too. Both parents, not just one. I think it's both parents spread themselves too thin, and it really wreaks havoc on your own personal mental health.
It really does.
Well, Jen, thanks so much for being on today. I really appreciate you, because this is such an interesting topic to me. And as a service provider in the schools, I'm always wanting to make sure that we're doing everything we can for our families and the kiddos. But I'm really interested in hearing about how you deal with some of the older kids. I would love to have you come back when I go through the different age groups next season. I'll be looking more into that elementary age group. So
that is where I spend a chunk of my time.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks so much again.
And thank you, Jen.
Look forward to having you back. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Feel free to join the OT Corner community by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you have a topic you want to hear about, or if you would like to come on the show, feel free to contact Jennifer at theotcorner.com. We would love to hear from you. All information from the show is listed in the episode notes. We know you can listen to anyone, so we appreciate you stopping by. Until next time, thanks again.